So my job, first of all, is to welcome you by reminding you of the important place. Can I have the slides up, please? Important place that Stanford has in the history of the technology that we're discussing today, the technology of the internet. It was 40 years ago, in 1968, that BBN got the contract to lay the technology that began to be the core of the internet that was deployed in 1969 here. It was 35 years ago that Vint Cerf started working on the protocols that would eventually become TCP/IP. It was 14 years ago that a couple of grad students began a company called Yahoo in a dorm room here at Stanford. And just about 10 years ago that this site just went up and noticed the very cool copyright sign at the bottom. And it was in 2002 that Tim Wu was here thinking about these principles and putting them together in a form that has become a compelling framing idea for this debate of network neutrality. But I want to bring you back to a debate that happened just about 8 years ago at the Stanford Law School, a conference called The Policy Implications of End-to-End. Extraordinarily boring title. It was my idea, this title. And it brought together some of the key framers of the early architecture of the internet. And that hearing and discussion framed many of the issues that have continued to be at the center of this debate about network neutrality. And midway through that hearing, a former economist at the FCC, a professor from the University of Pennsylvania, Jerry Fallhaber, offered this intervention. He said, Adam Smith, who we all think of as the greatest advocate of the free market, was the first to point out that producers never meet, but that they conspire against the public, always trying to figure out how to monopolize, cartelize, and otherwise get more profits out of the public. Only because there were a whole lot of them competing was that they weren't able to get away with that cartelization. Nonetheless, they continue to try. Producers will always search for ways to escape competition through marketing, customer lock-in, predatory pricing, network effects, etc. Now, what Jerry added to this obvious point from Adam Smith was what I think is the critical point to recognize here. As he said, technology is simply one more set of strategic variables in their, the producer's, quiver. The question they ask, he said, is can we structure our technologies in ways which essentially permit us to build barriers to entry? Can we change the code to defeat competition? And then he asked, so where does the end-to-end argument figure into this? Well, if I translate this into planet economics, that might have to be capitalized, I don't know. End-to-end, Jerry said, in engineering is the equivalent of perfect competitive markets that economists know and love. It's the thing that makes it all transparent, it's open, anybody can do anything. Now it's this last phrase that I want you to focus on here. It's the thing, end-to-end, or what we now call network neutrality, that makes it all transparent, open, such that anybody can do anything. Now the point I want to make, actually 4 points I want to make here, are this, following from Jerry's insight here. Number one, it was a technology that gave us something here, an architecture that gave us something here, what Jerry called this thing. That thing gave us transparency, openness, and freedom in the sense of anybody can do anything, what we otherwise call competition. Point two, in a concentrated market, owners have the power to change that thing, the power to change the architecture, using it now as a tool not to facilitate competition, but to weaken competition. One more arrow in their quiver, designed to protect themselves, as Adam Smith said, against competition. Number three, now of course, the technology that we celebrate, the internet, has given us important social and political and educational value. This is incredibly important. But we need to remember, this is Stanford, not Berkeley. Those kind of lefty ideas are cool and great, but the really important thing to focus on in the great power of what the internet gave us is to recognize that the transparent, open, and anybody can do anything technology of the internet gave us enormous economic value too, money. It drove the economic growth of the 1990s, the biggest proportion coming from the growth that grew from this technology, which leads to the final point. Before we allow it to change, the burden should be on those who would change its architecture. We should be essentially conservative here, where conservative is a small c. See, very small c right there. Conservative in the sense of being skeptical of hand-waving theories about how changing the basic architecture will bring us such enormous value, and instead face a series of facts about what did give us enormous value. For example, here's another neutral, open network, the electricity grid. It's transparent, open, anybody can do anything on it. As long as you know the protocols, you can plug any technology into it. Now, we could imagine a world where when you plugged something in, the network would ask you, well, is it a Panasonic or a Sony TV you're plugging in? Is it radio or television? Is it pay TV or free TV? And then, depending upon the answer to these questions, allocate the resource according to that information. It's possible to imagine an electricity grid like that. Would it be better? Can we imagine that it would be better? Well, I think economists would tell us it's possible it would be better. But my point is, we would need a very strong demonstration from people other than the kind of coin-operated experts that tend to populate Washington these days, that this is in fact right that we would advance economic growth with this change. And I think we should be skeptical. We should have a kind of Missouri attitude here. Show me, right? Show me that innovation won't be harmed from this change. Show me investment won't be choked. Show me competition will continue. And until you show me that, don't allow this to change. Now, when many people have tried to demand of network owners that they show the benefit from the change, they've said it's too hard. They said, wait and see till we have a problem. They used to say, this is a solution in search of a problem. They used to say that at least before Pearl Jam was silenced by AT&T when they tried to criticize the president, or Verizon blocked pro-choice text messaging, or BitTorrent was blocked by Comcast in the efforts to distribute content. They used to say these sorts of things, and they used to emphasize that there wasn't a problem here, but even if there weren't a problem here right now, this perspective misses an important point. Here in the Valley, venture capitalists now are investing money in the future. And when they invest that money in the future, they invest asking a single question: what will the world look like then when this technology needs to be deployed and profit made from this technology? And uncertainty about what the world will look like then raises the cost of these new technologies and therefore lowers the investment in those new technologies. Now, Not 5 years from now, but right now. If they believe the platform will be controlled tomorrow, there will be less investment today. Now, this is why, for almost 10 years, we have been asking the FCC to make a clear statement of policy about this critical infrastructure. Asking the FCC and Congress, too, to make a clear statement that what we used to call the end-to-end principle, what we now call net neutrality, is a core principle of this infrastructure. A clear statement that providers in this context would look to when they select the business model that they will deploy internet technology under. A clear statement that leads them to a consistent policy driving towards deploying the kind of broadband that facilitates open innovation and competition. Now, if the FCC did this, my view is the businesses would follow. It's cheaper, more rational to follow this clear statement of the world that the FCC will help guarantee we live in, rather than play the games of trying to undermine that clear policy statement. Now today, the subject of these two panels will focus on something called broadband network management practices. And this is a series of hearings inspired in part by a complaint filed by Free Press, on whose board I sit, against an action taken by Comcast in a conflict over the distribution of BitTorrent packets. And this conflict raises significant concern because the representations of Comcast about what they were doing turned out to be misrepresentations about what they had done. And that raised fundamental questions about trust. A company that said, we will deploy the internet in a way that guarantees an opportunity for this open innovation. The question was, can we trust this institution? And so at a packed hearing at the Harvard Law School, I couldn't find a picture, so this is Second Life's version of the Harvard Law School. That trust was once again eroded when it turned out that the hearing was packed with representatives of Comcast. Now, we saved lots of room here for them this day, but they didn't come today. So even less trust was resulting from this exchange. But I think the key to focus on in thinking about these problems, difficult problems of network management, is that in an important sense, we are here facing these problems because of a failure in FCC policy. It's because in all of these moments over the last 10 years, the FCC has failed to make it absolutely clear that network owners, if they're building the internet, need to build it neutrally. It's that failure of clear policy that makes us wonder why exactly is Comcast doing what they're doing at the network layer? Secondly, if we had right policy, I don't think that we would be talking about questions of trust. I don't think the FCC, the Department of Justice after the IBM case was talking about whether we trust IBM, or trust Microsoft, or trust Google. You don't talk about trusting a company just like you don't talk about trusting a tiger, even though the brand management for tigers has very cute images that they try to sell you on how beautiful and wonderful the tiger is. If you looked at that picture and you thought to yourself, the great thing for my child to play with this creature, you'd be a fool, because a tiger has a nature. The nature is not one you trust with your child. And likewise, a company has a nature, and thank God it does. Its nature is to produce economic value and wealth for its shareholders. We don't trust it to follow good public policy. We trust it to follow that objective. Public policy is designed to make it profitable for them to behave in a way that serves the objectives of public policy, in this context, the objectives of an open, neutral network. It makes it more profitable for them to behave than to misbehave. We set public policy to create the incentives for them to pick the right business model, a business model consistent with the objectives of an open, neutral network, a public policy that drives them to do the right thing, not because they're good and virtuous, but because doing the right thing makes them the most money. That's the trust a corporation can be trusted to have, and we should set public policy in light of that fact. So, for example, the business model we should want broadband developers to deploy is one that focuses on abundance of broadband capacity and neutrality in the opportunities that broadband infrastructure offers to innovators everywhere, not a business model focused on scarcity and the opportunity of controlling those who deploy for this network. Well, so how could we get that policy here? Well, again, I think the key is to recognize, even if it's technology, as Jerry Fallhaber was telling us, or architecture in the network that produced good policy, even if it was the end-to-end design of the network that produced this open, neutral network that innovators could build on top of, it doesn't follow that regulators should be thinking about how to regulate technology. There will be lots of times that there are games that are going on in the code, but I think we need to recognize a limit in the competence of government regulators to actually evaluate the code and to understand why exactly the games were played in the particular way in which they were played. There is a limit in the government's competence here. There are plenty of legitimate reasons why games would be played in the code, legitimate reasons we think of as proper network management. There are legitimate ways to do that, but my point is, rather than thinking about how best to regulate this code, we need to think about how to regulate the sort of things that the FCC can see very well, can understand very well, and ask the question whether it's sufficient to regulate the things they can regulate easily to assure that what happens at the network layer is not the kind of behavior that destroys the neutral network. Things like contracts and relationships between businesses. That's the stuff that the sort of capacity of the FCC can deal with, and that's the stuff, I think, potentially, that could provide the right incentives for the right business model to drive the objective of network neutrality. So what does that regulation look like? Well, the earliest version, I think, builds on what was originally Chairman Powell's Four Freedoms. I think we should think of it as Powell's Four Freedoms Plus. So what is the plus? Well, among network neutrality advocates, there's basically been two clear descriptions of what the plus is. One, economists refer to as the zero price regulation, ZPR. ZPR is what's, for example, built into Representative Markey's proposed bill, where he says, if a broadband network provider prioritizes data of a particular type, then it must prioritize all data of that type, regardless of origin, without imposing a surcharge. So everything flows at the same price, at the same speed, according to the access provider. Now, I'm going to get some people upset by this, but here you go. I'm actually against ZPR. I don't think it's a good idea. I think, first of all, the title is very misleading. It's a bad title because when you say zero price regulation, people think that companies like Yahoo aren't paying for the internet. Of course they're paying for the internet. They pay an enormous amount of money for the bandwidth that their services provide. But I do think that ZPR regulation blocks productive discrimination. Discriminations that actually help facilitate the spread of broadband and growth without risking a threat to network neutrality. So for example, if iFilm wants fast pipes so it can send its films very, very, very fast across the network, but I don't want fast pipes because I just have boring emails to send, we have a structure under ZPR that doesn't allow that distinction to be recognized. So ZPR is one kind of regulation network neutrality proponents have offered. Here's a second, what I call zero discriminatory surcharge rules, ZDS. So for example, that says if you've got a provider that's saying Google pays us X, but iFilm pays us 2X, that's a problem. That kind of discrimination among equivalent providers is the problem. Because if the FCC allows that, it at least creates the possibility of an incentive for a destructive business model. And by that I mean a business model where the incentive of the provider is to inflate the premium price by creating or sustaining scarcity in the ordinary provision of network services to everybody else. But the important difference between the second rule and the first is that the second rule does allow non-discriminatory tiering, meaning each company is offered a most favored nations clause, meaning, for example, a provider could say there's a surcharge for video, but everybody pays the same price for that surcharge. The same price, meaning there isn't the incentive to play games among different providers to facilitate exactly the wrong business model, a business model of scarcity rather than abundance. Now, it's my view that this is where the FCC should start. And it should modify that clear, strong principle in light of a very clear target, target that I think terrifies the providers, that we get to broadband as a commodity. Not a commodity in the sense that oil is a commodity regulated by OPEC, that's OPEC's brand if you've never seen it before, but in the sense of a commodity of chips or PCs or wheat or sand, a commodity where there's fundamental competition in the provision of this commodity, driving the price of that commodity down. That's the objective, and we get there through a constant focus on this as the end. Now, one more point about this. In this objective, the principle of end-to-end or network neutrality should be thought of as a very central principle, just like the First Amendment is thought of as a central principle in the regulation of speech. It is a heavy weight against any intervention or any change that compromises that principle. But just as the First Amendment is but a heavy weight and not an absolute bar, so too this would not function necessarily as an absolute bar where there are countervailing interests that don't compromise the underlying incentive to produce neutral, open, competitive network. Finally, I don't know if you remember this book by Susskind that revived this idea inside the Bush administration of an opposition to something called reality-based policymaking. I'm one who has some hope that we're going to get out of that mentality of anti-reality-based policymaking, but I want to end with two very important realities here. Right? Here's reality number one. The embarrassing fact that when somebody lists the top 10 countries in broadband penetration by population, we're nowhere on the list. Our broadband is not acceptable for the United States. Reality number two, that despite the objectives and the policy statements and the hopes of many over the last 10 years, we still have not achieved a clear network neutrality policy that is viewed as enforceable and meaningful from the FCC or Congress. Now, one conclusion you could draw from those two realities is that the absence of regulation does not produce abundant broadband, because we've effectively had no regulation, which the providers have been opposing, yet we don't have broad growth in broadband relative to other countries. Now, that would be a little bit unfair, because they could respond, well, we've had this uncertain question about whether we're going to get regulation, and that's why we haven't invested as much as we would invest if we just clearly knew we could do whatever the hell we wanted. But there is one certainty here. In the most important space for competition, we see which architecture has worked. And the architecture which has worked doesn't depend on promises or trust. It depends upon what the architecture enables. And what it enables is maximizing competition in the space that provides real value in this economy and the content and applications. We need to put away in this debate the radical theories that would drive us away from that reality. We need to be conservative in this debate and preserve what has worked in driving this economy. And what has worked is a neutral network. Thank you very much.